Well, I hope everyone had a good night's sleep last night and you're all refreshed for more of the Word. And yesterday's session gave you the adequate background that you need to understand the advanced things that I'm going to be sharing today. So this is our fourth session in the series. We are understanding that the entire Bible speaks about Yeshua from Genesis to Revelation, that He created the heavens and the earth in Genesis, made covenant with Abraham, and in Exodus gave the Torah at Mount Sinai, was the bridegroom in a marriage with Israel. But the book of Revelation, chapter 1, verse 1, starts out by saying the revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach. So He's being revealed in Revelation. He's from Genesis to Revelation. So the whole Bible explains to us Yeshua's covenant relationship with the nation of Israel. And He is conducting His affairs according to His covenant that He made with Abraham and His covenant promises to him, that the descendants of Abraham would, as we're told in Genesis in chapter 15, they would be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, Genesis 15, verse 13. But they would be delivered, ultimately. And that was speaking, of course, of the historical Egyptian exodus. So the nation of Israel was unfaithful in their covenant promises at Mount Sinai. And as a result, according to the marriage terms, the unfaithful wife, the house of Jacob, got exiled in the nations of the world. And a promise was made in the Torah that after they got exiled in the nations of the world, that when they repented and had a change of heart, that the God of Israel would move and they would be regathered to the land of Israel. The one who is seen that would lead and accomplish that task is the Messiah. Biblically, according to the Torah, what makes the Messiah is the Messiah gathers the exiles of Israel. So this is the claim and the testimony of the New Testament. Yeshua Himself said in John chapter 10, verses 16 and 17, that He is laying down His life to take two sheepfolds and make them one. This is repeated in John chapter 11, verses 49 through 52, that two nations who are the children of God scattered abroad, Yeshua died to make one. Acts chapter 1, following His resurrection, Yeshua was asked, are you going to at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? And He answered that you're going to be empowered with the Ruach HaKodesh, the Holy Spirit, and you will be my witnesses in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and under the uttermost parts of the earth. And this is in fulfillment of a prophecy in Jeremiah chapter 16, verses 14 through 16, that the exiles of Israel would return in the context of the Almighty sending out fishers for them. And so literally, the disciples of Yeshua were fishermen who went out to fish for the exiles of Israel. Paul was called in Acts chapter 9 by Yeshua, and his ministry focused on going out and proclaim Yeshua as Messiah a return to Torah in the ingathering of the exiles. So he's going to the places in Asia Minor and in the West where the Northern Kingdom was exiled. Now, we don't have record of it in our Bible, but some of the disciples of Yeshua went east for the exiles of Israel, proclaiming the message to them. So we're told in the New Testament that there were three primary men as pillars in the early church. And they were Paul, Peter, and John, are mentioned as three pillars of the church. So we have Paul's letters where he is explaining Yeshua to those in exile. And then ending yesterday's session, we looked at Peter's letter in 1 Peter, seeing that he wrote this to the northern kingdom in exile, as we see in 1 Peter 1:1, those who are living in the region of Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, who he refers to as being elect of God. And that's going back to the Torah, where the nation of Israel is elect of God. And then he told in 1 Peter chapter 1, verse 10, that the prophets prophesied of the grace that would come to you. And we looked at the book of Hosea, where there was a prophecy that after the northern kingdom was judged with no mercy, not my people, that they would become sons of the living God, and they would join themselves with the house of Judah and appoint themselves one head. And then in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 25, it says that you were sheep going astray, but you've returned to the shepherd and bishop of your soul. Ultimately, the physical ingathering of the 12 tribes of Israel, ending their exile, returning to the land of Israel, Messiah leading them, and him being glorified, is reserved for what we call the second coming. It is the major purpose for the tribulation period. And what I'm going to be showing you, either in this session or next session, depending upon how things go, is the designated period of time for this regathering to take place is the 3.5 years that precede Yeshua setting his feet down on the Mount of Olives, which is commonly called the Great Tribulation. There is more in the Bible written to explain the situation and the circumstances in the world and among the people of the God of Israel, describing the days that are associated with this reunification and gathering of the 12 tribes of Israel, than any other subject in the Bible, because those days are such important and critical days, and the Bible says that there isn't any other days of the earth as far as the earth going through distress and affliction, than those days where these events take place. One of the points I made on our first session, one of the principles I said you need to know in order to understand the Bible and even the world in which we're living, is that the history of the world is outlined according to Yeshua's relationship with the nation of Israel. That is how history on the earth is designed by the God of Israel, to proceed according to his relationship with the nation of Israel. Earth history isn't haphazardly happening. So, in that perspective, the book of Daniel outlines for us, beginning with the Babylonian captivity of the house of Judah, an outline of world powers that would be ruling in the earth suppressing Israel in exile. And we have the head of gold in the book of Daniel as being the Babylonians. And then we have the arms of silver, which is the Medes and the Persians. And then you have the Grecian Empire of brass. Then you have the legs that represent the Roman Empire. The beast system of the end of days in the image of Nebuchadnezzar in the book of Daniel is 10 toes. The 10 toes is iron mixed with clay. The word mixed, if we go to Daniel in chapter 2 in verse 41. Daniel chapter 2 verse 41. It says, "For as much as you saw the iron mixed with clay." The word mixed is the Strong's number 6151. It's an Aramaic word, and the word is Arab. The word mixed is Arab. So it's iron mixed with clay is this beast of the end of days. And then we are told in Daniel 2:42, "And as the toes of the feet were part of iron and part of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly broken. Where you saw iron mixed with miry clay, they shall mingle themselves with the seed of men." So we're told that the iron and the clay would seek to mingle with each other, intermix with each other. And this is the beast system of the end of days. And we are told in verse 44, "And in the days of these kings," that is the 10 toes, "shall the God of heaven set up a kingdom which shall never be destroyed." That's Messiah's messianic kingdom. "And the kingdom shall not be left to other people, but it shall break in pieces and consume all these kingdoms, and it will stand forever. For as much as you saw that the stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, and that it broke into pieces." The stone broke into pieces, the iron, the brass, the clay, the silver, and the gold. "The great God has made known to the king what shall come to pass hereafter, and the dream is certain, and the interpretation is sure." So what we're told is that there was a stone that came, and the stone crushed the toes. The stone then became a great mountain. This is a reference to the Messiah. He's the stone, and in his second coming, he's got to crush the beast system of the end of days, and then he is going to set up his kingdom, wherein Israel gathered from the nations, the 12 tribes of Israel united, are going to rule and reign with him, and the nation of Israel will never go into exile again after they're regathered by the Messiah in messianic times. So this is an outline for us of earth history and where we're going. The 10 toes is iron mixed with clay, intermingled with clay. The iron represents the West, and the remnant of the legs of iron, the Roman Empire, which represents the West. The clay, I believe, represents the Arab world or Islam. And who Israel is fighting against today is Western secular humanism that wants one world government and one world democratic socialism and has been actively working to globalize the world and to integrate the world and to make that possible. That is a beast that Israel in exile is fighting against. In addition, there's another beast that Israel in exile is fighting against, and that is Islam, who wants to seek to destroy Israel in exile. And both are fighting against Israel in exile, but in different ways. They're both fighting, but they're doing it in different ways. So I know you've heard various teachings about who or what the beast is, or the beast system. And what we tend to do when we study this is we tend to look at it through what I call a Greek perspective. Greek perspective is yes and no, black and white. It is or it isn't. Hebraic perspective is it's multi-layered, multifaceted, and one thing interloops and interconnects with something else. That's a Hebraic perspective. So perhaps the last few years you may have heard a teaching that is Islam the beast? Is Islam the beast? The answer is no. Is Islam a beast? The answer is yes. So, you may have heard, you know, the efforts to bring about one world government and the uniting of the Europe, and how the United States and the North American Union is leading the efforts of seeking to bring about one world government. The Arab world is not actively working and leading the effort to bring about one world government. That effort's being done from Western powers. The United States government is leading that effort. So is that the beast? No, it's not the beast, it's a beast. You see, the beast system of the end of days is a combination of the previous beasts. So the first major beast that subjugated Israel was Egypt, Pharaoh. But we have the Babylonian Empire is a beast. The Medes and the Persians, a beast. Greece is a beast. Rome, a beast. The Ten Toes, secular humanism. One world democratic socialism, a beast. And Islam, a beast. And ultimately, all of these entities and their philosophies is at work in the world today to subjugate Israel in exile. And it's these systems is who Israel in exile needs to overcome. And they can only overcome these systems through standing on the covenant that Yeshua made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, diligently seeking to follow the Torah, because the God of Israel promised that if His people would cling to the covenant, cling to Him, and cling to following His Torah, He would fight for them. So, the battle in the end of days, Revelation chapter 12, is the birth of Israel to be regathered, the 12 tribes united, and this composite beast system. And they have war with each other for the last 3.5 years. As we see in Revelation 12, verse 7, there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels. And so we see we're going to have a major conflict between the beast system, who is seeking to prevent Israel being regathered, by the Messiah in the end of days. And this conflict is purposed and ordained by the God of Israel. We can't avoid it. It's a part of His sovereign will and a sovereign plan that this conflict happen in the end of days. Now in Zechariah chapter 9 and verse 13, the conflict is specified this way. When I have bent Judah for me and filled the bow with Ephraim, Judah and Ephraim are both houses of Israel, and I've raised up your sons, O Zion, against your sons, O Greece. See, he's raising up the sons of Zion to oppose the sons of Greece. Historically, when did the sons of Zion oppose the sons of Greece? It was in the days of the Greek ruler Antiochus Epiphanes IV, who seek to impose Greek rule against the Jews who were living in the land, and a rebellion took place by Judah Maccabee and his sons. Remember I told you the principle that biblical history is prophecy. That conflict in that rebellion is a prophecy of the end of days. And these are the things that the God of Israel gave us to understand the redemption and the epic battle between the sons of Zion and the beast system of the end of days. So, from the time that the Assyrians took the first of the 12 tribes of Israel into captivity, which was around 7, ultimately, the final taking, history tells us, is about 721 BC, that Israel's been subjugated to these Gentile nations on the earth, who the Bible refers to as beasts in the Torah. He says you'll be taken captive and the beasts of the field will rule over you. But because we believe and the Bible teaches that we're going to have a messianic era in the end, where Messiah is going to rule with Israel redeemed and Gentile foreign powers will not be subjugating Israel anymore, what then is the transition period of time to when Gentile foreign powers are subjugating Israel, persecuting them? What's the transition to when they quit doing that? In the process of Israel being regathered and enter into messianic times where Messiah would rule over them and Israel be the head of the nations, what do we call the transition where we begin the process of the end of Gentile rule and the beginning of Israel being regathered and Israel ruling and being the head of all nations? What do we call that transition period? It's called the tribulation. The tribulation is the transition when the Gentile powers end. Because what happens at the end of the tribulation? The stone comes and crushes the 10 toes. That's the end of the Gentile rule on the earth. It sets up a kingdom. That's the completion of the redemption. So the purpose of the tribulation period is to make the transition from Gentile rule over Israel and ending Israel being in exile, Messiah to gather them, and by Messiah, A, gathering his people, and B, judging the nations, he gets glorified. So when historically did we have Yahweh Yeshua gathering his people and judging those who were enslaving them? That's the major central story of the Torah. Gathering Israel from the historical Egyptian exile. When he regathered them, he judged Egypt. So we're taught that in the Torah so that we will understand as we approach Messianic times, that's how it's going to happen again. When he regathers Israel from exile, he's going to judge the nations. But what is the event that causes the nations to ultimately be judged? The event in the end of days that ultimately causes the nations to be judged and to fall with Messiah's coming is the nations collectively decide to divide the land of Israel in the city of Jerusalem. Biblically, the nations deciding to divide the land of Israel in the city of Jerusalem is a direct challenge to the God of Israel, Yahweh Yeshua's covenant with Abraham. Because the nations are making a declaration, we do not acknowledge Yahweh Yeshua's covenant with Abraham in the land that was granted. And we will, in our power, seek to enforce our solution for peace in the region. And we reject the Prince of Peace, who he is and his ways. That is the challenge that the nations make to the God of Israel, and he stands up to the challenge. So the end of days is all about giving you the details of understanding the events that surrounding these things. And more is written in the Bible to explain to you these events, because it is a time of Jacob's trouble. And there isn't any other day since Adam and Eve that will compare to this. So the God of Israel and his mercy gives us more information about those times than any other period in history. So that's what we need to understand. Now, from evangelical Christian traditional teaching on the end of days, we have been set up through our religious doctrines to be blindsided by these events, understanding them. Because we've been taught that the events of the end of days is all happening to accomplish the goal of getting people on the earth who don't believe in Yeshua to believe in Yeshua. So that we have been taught in evangelical Christianity that those who do believe in Yeshua, we get a free ticket. We go up in the pre-trib rapture. We get a free ticket from all the problems. But all the problems is for Jews who don't believe in Yeshua in the world that doesn't believe in Yeshua to basically scare them out of their wits so that they will believe in Yeshua. And he's going to scare them out of their wits to save everyone. That believing that Yeshua is Messiah is the goal. Well, what did we discuss in a previous section, in a previous session? That Yahweh Yeshua redeemed the children of Israel out of Egypt, and those who came out put the blood of the Lamb on the doorpost. That was only the beginning of the journey. The completion of the journey was getting into the Promised Land, getting to Jerusalem, where a king would rule over them. That was the completion of the journey. So the church teaches that the goal is putting the blood of the Lamb on the doorpost. And we need to get everyone to get to the goal. But the goal wasn't putting the blood of the lamb on the doorpost. The goal was to put the blood of the lamb on the doorpost and get to the promised land. So that's what we need to understand that the tribulation is about. It is to gather the exiles of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel, that the 12 tribes of Israel would recognize who the Messiah is and realize they need to follow Torah. Judging the nations, and through the Messiah miraculously redeeming and gathering his people in the sight of all the nations, that the nations would see it and they also would want to join themselves to the redemption that is directly coming unto the 12 tribes of Israel. So evangelical Christianity has taught the end of days through this layout of time, through the eyes, through the foundation, the premise of what's doctrinally called dispensationalism. And dispensationalism is the doctrine that says before the death of Messiah on the tree is the age of law. After the death of Messiah on the tree is the age of grace. So starting with that premise, age of law, age of grace, now they define age of grace as the church age, and then the church, everyone who believes in Yeshua, is the bride. And the bride in the church gets rewarded by escaping problems of the end of days. And the end of days is a 7-year period of time followed by a 1,000-year messianic age. So that pre-trib rapture, 7-year tribulation, and 1,000-year messianic age is all based upon age of law, age of grace. Well, you are here because you understand that following Yeshua isn't choosing between Torah or grace, because in Exodus chapter 20, verse 6, it says he shows mercy to those that love him and keeps his commandments. Furthermore, regarding this issue, in Psalm 103, verses 17 and 18, it says, the mercy of the Lord is from everlasting to everlasting. His mercy is from everlasting to everlasting. There isn't an age of grace. It's from everlasting to everlasting. Verse 18, his mercy from everlasting to everlasting is to such as keep his covenant and those that remember his commandments to do them. Notice his mercy from everlasting to everlasting is to those who keep his commandments, those who seek to please him by following the Torah. Of course, we already know you don't get saved by following the Torah. Following the Torah is something you do after you're saved by grace through faith. Because why? They put the blood of the Lamb on the doorpost. That's salvation. And then they came to Mount Sinai and were shown how to live as a redeemed people. That the tools that the God of Israel gave us to understand his redemptive plan, to understand the coming of the Messiah, these tools that he gave us are the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, the annual festivals, which are celebrations of his redemptive acts, the new moon, dietary laws, and that the principle in the Torah that biblical history is prophecy, and the events that happen in the Torah are prophecies of what will happen to Israel in its future. It's those principles that he gave us to understand the Messiah and the redemptive plan. Colossians chapter 2 and verses 16 and 17 says, Let no man judge you in meat or in drink or respect of a holy day of the new moon or the Sabbath, which are a shadow of things to come. They're a shadow or a blueprint of something to come. Paul wrote this letter after the death of Yeshua on the tree. And he says that meat and drink, that's dietary laws. The holy days, that's the annual festivals. The new moon or the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath, is a blueprint of something to come. To come is Messiah's second coming. It's a blueprint of something to come. The body or the substance of the dietary laws and the Sabbath and the festivals and the new moon. The substance of those things, the body of it, is the Messiah. Or it teaches you about the Messiah. Well, if most Christians don't know from John 10, verses 16 and 17, and John 11, verses 49 through 52, if they don't know that Yeshua died on the tree to gather the 12 tribes of Israel, so if they still haven't figured out His first coming, what's the probability that they understand His second coming, and how many Christians know how the dietary laws in the new moon, in the Sabbath, and the annual festivals teach us about Yeshua's second coming? If they do, which I'd like to submit to you that they actually do that, how prepared are we for His second coming? Now, the God of Israel wants His people to be prepared. He wants them to know what His plan is. So that's why He gave the Torah and He said, do the Sabbath each week. Because you're practicing it. You're learning the redemptive plan. Do the annual festivals. Because if you really are celebrating what they were given for, you're keeping the knowledge and the understanding of His redemptive plan. So if the enemy wants to keep us blinded to it, what would he have to do? Tell us, oh, the Torah is old and done away with. Doesn't pertain to you today. It was another covenant. It was another era. And in doing so, he's selling you a bill of goods so that you will not understand the Messiah and His coming and the things surrounding it. But the God of Israel in His mercy wants His people to understand. So in His mercy, you know what He does before the Messiah comes? He sends Elijah, or the spirit of Elijah, or the ministry of Elijah, which in Matthew in chapter 17, Matthew chapter 17, in verse 10, the disciples ask Him, why do the scribes teach that Elijah must first come or precede Messiah's coming? Yeshua answered and said, Elijah truly shall first come. He truly shall first come and restore all things. Do you realize you can't restore something unless it originally was, but something happened to it, caused it to be in a deteriorated condition, and then you've got to restore it back to what it originally was? Well, what was the original? The original was Yahweh Yeshua's covenant with Abraham, where in fulfilling that covenant, He brought the children of Israel out of Egypt and gave them the Torah. That's the original. But then His people broke the covenant, quit following the Torah, doesn't understand who the Messiah is. But Elijah is going to come and refocus the message. And we see Elijah's refocused message in Malachi in chapter 4. Malachi chapter 4, beginning in verse 4, this is the message of Elijah. Remember the Torah of Moses, my servant, Remember the Torah of Moses. Remember is the Hebrew way of saying follow it, do it. Remember the Torah of Moses. Verse 5, behold, I send you Elijah the prophet. Why is Elijah the prophet coming? He's coming with the message of remember the Torah of Moses. I send you Elijah the prophet before the coming and great and dreadful day of the Lord. I'm going to send you Elijah before the coming and great and dreadful day of the Lord. What is that speaking about? The tribulation period. Elijah's got to come before the tribulation period. And what will Elijah do before the tribulation period? He will turn the heart of the fathers to the children and the heart of the children to the fathers. In other words, he will turn, he will be used with the help of the Holy Spirit to turn the people of the God of Israel to the Torah and to the covenant made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Do you see any evidence that that's happening in the world in which we're living if you believe that we're close to Messiah's second coming? The answer is yes. And it's happening among all, with people of different denominational backgrounds. And you know what we label this in modern times? Some call it the Messianic movement. Some call it the Hebrew Roots movement. The Messianic or Hebrew Roots movement is a return of the people who believe in Yeshua to the Torah and identifying with the fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. This is prophesied to happen before the coming and great and dreadful day of the Lord. You are a byproduct of the ministry of Elijah and the spirit of Elijah, because somehow 15 years ago you weren't keeping the Sabbath and the festivals, but here recently he's grabbed a hold of your heart somehow and turned your heart, and you have a heart for the Sabbath and the festivals and to understand the Messiah through Torah and through these celebrations. But why is it happening now? Why didn't it happen 100 years ago or 500 years ago? Why now? Because by returning to the Torah, it will give you the knowledge that you need, the understanding that you need to be prepared for Messiah's second coming. He's trying to prepare you for his second coming. Because if his second coming is about gathering the 12 tribes of Israel, and where you were at previously in your traditional churches wasn't preparing you for that, and then you're not ready for his second coming. But when Messiah is coming, he's coming for a bride. And hopefully the bride's got to make herself ready. And the bride will know who she's marrying. You know, traditional Christianity who views themselves as being the bride thinks that they're marrying a bridegroom that doesn't require them to keep the Torah. Can you imagine? He's the lawgiver. And they think they're married to somebody who doesn't want them to keep the law, yet he's the lawgiver. You know, if they actually enter into that marriage, they're going to be disappointed and upset. Maybe they may not like their bridegroom. You know, do they really want this marriage? Well, Messiah wants to be married to his bride. That's why he died for her. He wants her to make herself ready and be prepared. So in his love, in his great love, he sends the prophets. He sends Elijah to stir the hearts of his people to be ready for his coming. So that's what we need to talk about, is understanding those things. So one of the tools that he gave us to understand his second coming is the Sabbath. In this principle that biblical history is prophecy. So let's develop those principles so that we can accurately understand what the Bible says about Messiah's second coming, so that we can be prepared for it, so that when things happen in the earth that's going to cause you to not sit still anymore, that you will recognize and discern what's going on and know what to do. You will be prepared. To begin with, Isaiah chapter 46. Isaiah chapter 46, verse 9 says, "Remember the former things of old. I am God and there is none else. I am God and there is none like me." Why is there no one like him? Because verse 10, declaring the end from the beginning. Only he can tell you the end of days in the very beginning of the creation of the world. No one else can do that. Declaring the end from the beginning. And from ancient times, the things that are not yet done. I've already told you from ancient times, the things that even haven't even happened yet. Saying, my counsel will stand and I will do all my pleasure. The end of verse 11. I have spoken it when? In the beginning. I will bring it to pass. When? In the end. I have purposed it when? In the beginning. I will also do it. Do you realize when you're studying Torah, you're studying prophecy? And the book that gives you the best foundation for understanding prophecy is the book of Genesis. The book of Genesis is your foundation for understanding prophecy. Where does prophecy in the book of Genesis begin? In the very first chapter. That the creation of the heavens and the earth, as outlined, we're told, in 7 days, that each day in creation is a prophecy of 1,000 years of time. From the creation of Adam and Eve in the garden. This principle is spelled out for us in Psalm chapter 90 and verse 4. Psalm chapter 90 and verse 4 says, 1,000 years in your sight is but yesterday when it's past and as a watch in the night. 1,000 years is as yesterday or a day. 1,000 years is likened to a day. Peter quotes this verse in 1 Peter, in actually 2 Peter, chapter 3. I'm going to begin reading in verse 8. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. But beloved, be not ignorant of this one thing. You know, there's several places in the New Testament where we find the phrase, be not ignorant. Those are the places where we're ignorant. When it says, be not ignorant, pay attention to what's being emphasized. Don't be ignorant that one day is with the Lord 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day. Quoting from Psalm chapter 90, verse 4. So, we got to do a silah, meditate, think about. One day is with the Lord 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day. What day is it talking about? The days of creation. That was a prophetic foreshadowing. So we understand the principle now. One day is 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. Verse 10. But the day of the Lord. Don't be ignorant that one day is with the Lord 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. That's verse 8. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. Verse 10. But the day of the Lord. How long is the day of the Lord? Let me go slower. Don't be ignorant that one day is with the Lord 1,000 years and 1,000 years is one day, but the day of the Lord. It's 1,000 years. Who's the Lord? It's his day, but who's the Lord? It's his day. The Lord is Yeshua HaMashiach. What day is his day that's 1,000 years? We call it the Messianic era. Why is it his day? Because that's when he rules and reigns in the earth. Regathers Israel and teaches the Torah to all nations, and Israel's the blessing to all nations. He's got to do that in his day, in the day that he gets glorified. But here it says, but the day of the Lord will come. It starts out, it will come as a thief in the night. The 1,000 years begins as a thief in the night. So when do the 1,000 years begin? When does the 1,000 years begin? At the beginning of the tribulation. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. The tribulation starts the Messianic era. The tribulation starts the day of the Lord. Well, let's go back to Genesis chapter 1 and see if we can understand the definition of a day. It says in Genesis chapter 1 verse 5, evening and morning was the first day. Verse 8, evening and morning was the second day. Verse 13, evening and morning was the third day, etc. What does a day consist of? An evening and a morning. So, how do we define the day of the Lord? Evening and a morning. So, what do we call the evening part of the day of the Lord? The tribulation. Now, what do we call the transition between the darkness in the evening to the daylight of the day, that transition period? We call it dawn. And if you study Messiah's coming, he comes at the dawn of the day. He breaks the darkness and begins the day, a day that is all light because he rules and reigns. So in order to understand the end of days, you have to understand and know the definition of the day of the Lord. And you can't get a proper definition of the day of the Lord unless you understand that biblical history is prophecy. And a day is outlined in the Torah in Genesis in chapter 1. And that the weekly Sabbath teaches you about the day of the Lord. Isaiah in chapter 58 in verse 13. Isaiah 58 verse 13 says, if you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, the Sabbath is called my holy day, and call the Sabbath the delight, the holy of the Lord honorable. The Sabbath, my holy day. The Sabbath, the holy of the Lord. The Sabbath is the day of the Lord. Now, the weekly Sabbath is a foreshadowing, as Paul explained in Colossians chapter 2, verses 16 and 17, which we read earlier, is a foreshadowing of Messiah's coming. So the weekly Sabbath is a rehearsal of the Messianic era. The weekly Sabbath, which is called the Day of the Lord, is a prophetic foreshadowing of the Messianic era, which is also called the Day of the Lord. How many of you have your life so organized each week that when the Sabbath comes, you are always prepared? You're always prepared for the Sabbath, in the moment of the Sabbath. Or it's like, oh my gosh, Sabbath is coming. What am I going to do? Am I ready? Did I do this? Did I do that? If you're like most of us, that's what we do. And you know what? He's getting us to understand what the day of the Lord is like. It's like, the day of the Lord's coming. All these events are happening. What am I going to do? Am I prepared? And probably that's where we're all at. Even myself. That's where we're at. It's like, it's coming, but am I ready? I'm not quite sure if I'm ready. I got to do this, I got to do that. I don't know if I can get it done in time. So we're rehearsing. He's letting us understand what it's like. So it's the day of the Lord. Now, let's look at the book of Revelation in chapter 1. Remember what the first verse says. The revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach. Do you know what that means? He's not fully revealed. Why would it start out by saying the revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach? if he was fully revealed. He's not fully revealed yet. This is explaining how he gets fully revealed. Who does he get fully revealed to? His people and to the world. How does he reveal himself to his people in the world? When he gathers the 12 tribes of Israel. So it says, the revelation of Yeshua HaMashiach, which God gave unto him to show to his servants. That word servants also means, it's a Greek word that goes back to the Hebrew, bond servant. To show his bond servant the things that must shortly come. Do you realize the book of Revelation wasn't written to everybody? It was only written to the bond servants of Yeshua. It's just written to the bond servants of Yeshua. Not those who even take the relationship casually, but those who are serious bondservants. Let me show you the setting of what John is explaining. It's in Revelation chapter 1, verse 10. I was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. Notice he's in the Spirit. He's being shown something in the future. But how can you be shown something in the future if the future hasn't come yet? Well, you can only do it in the Spirit. God can do it for you in the Spirit. So you was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. So like he was given this vision on Sunday, right? Well, isn't that the Lord's day? No. He's telling you he was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. What does that mean? The day of the Lord. He was propelled in the period of time in history known as the day of the Lord, which begins in the evening, tribulation, and ends in the morning. So he's going to show you the things that are happening during the tribulation and following the tribulation. And then at the end of the book of Revelation, it gives you some information following the day of the Lord, the Messianic era, the time of the new heavens and the new earth, which we would refer to as eternity. So the setting of the book of Revelation is the day of the Lord. What is the setting of many of the books of the prophets? Let's take, for example, the book of Joel. Joel, in chapter 1, verse 15, it says, alas, for the day of the Lord is at hand. The setting is the day of the Lord. Joel chapter 2 and verse 1. Blow the shofar in Zion, for the day of the Lord comes. Now, how is the day of the Lord described? Joel chapter 2 verse 2. It's a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness. That's tribulation. The day of the Lord begins with tribulation. So, do you realize the God of Israel had this book of Joel written a long time ago? And it was only written to communicate to a people about something that would happen in the day of the Lord. So he's skipping all the generations and telling generations between when this book was written to the day of the Lord. He's not really giving details about all those different generations, but he's telling you about a generation that's going to be living in the day of the Lord. Obadiah, one chapter. Obadiah chapter 1, verse 15. For the day of the Lord is near upon the heathen. The subject of the book of Obadiah is the day of the Lord, and to tell you what's happening in the day of the Lord. Let's look at Zephaniah. Zephaniah chapter 1 and verse 14 and verse 15 says, the great day of the Lord is near. It is near and hastens greatly. Even the voice of the day of the Lord. That day. Verse 15, that is the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord is a day of wrath, a day of trouble, of distress, of wastes, of desolation. It's a day of darkness and gloominess. The day of the Lord begins with tribulation. So look, the book of Zephaniah is written in the setting of the Day of the Lord. Joel, Day of the Lord. Obadiah, Day of the Lord. Zephaniah, Day of the Lord. Let's go to Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah chapter 14, verse 1 says, "Behold, the day of the Lord comes." That chapter is in the setting of the Day of the Lord. Now, I want to show you what happens in the Day of the Lord. Verse 2, "I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. The city will be taken, the houses riveled, the women ravished, and half the city will go into captivity." What happens in the Day of the Lord is the city of Jerusalem gets divided. Verse 3, "The Lord will go and fight against the nations as when he fought in the day of battle." In the Day of the Lord, the city of Jerusalem gets divided, and he fights against the nations. Verse 4, "And his feet will stand that day on the Mount of Olives." In the Day of the Lord, the city of Jerusalem gets divided. There's the God of Israel fights against the nations, and Messiah sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives. Then it says in verse 16, "It will come to pass that everyone that is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem shall go up from year by year to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." In the Day of the Lord, we have the dividing of the city of Jerusalem, God fighting, or the Messiah, fighting against the nations, him setting his feet down on the Mount of Olives, and all the nations going to Jerusalem to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. That's all happening in the Day of the Lord. So the Day of the Lord begins with the tribulation, but the Day of the Lord continues when Messiah sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives and when the nations are keeping the Feast of Tabernacles. Isaiah chapter 13. Isaiah chapter 13, verse 1. The burden of Babylon. Verse 6. "How ye, for the day of the Lord is at hand." Remember this principle, that biblical history is prophecy? Well, prophecy is written to tell you it's something that's happening in the time in which it's being written, but it's written at the same time to tell you what's going to happen in the future. The entire book of Isaiah is written in the setting of the Day of the Lord. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 12, "For the day of the Lord of hosts shall be upon every one that is proud and lofty, and upon every one that is lifted up, and he shall be brought low." We're told in Isaiah chapter 2, in verse 3, which is what's quoted whenever you have a Torah service on the Sabbath, that in the Day of the Lord all the nations will come to Jerusalem, and out of Zion shall go forth the Torah from Jerusalem. Isaiah chapter 13, we're told that in the Day of the Lord we have the fall of Babylon. So I could give you more examples, but what I'm trying to share with you is that the Day of the Lord is a major topic and setting of the end of days, and it's the subject of the book of Isaiah, Joel, Zephaniah, Zechariah 14. I'm not giving you a complete list. It is the setting of the book of Revelation. The book of Revelation gives you further details to build upon what was given in the prophets. It's in that period of time that we will have the transition of the end of Gentile rule. It's during the darkness part of the Day of the Lord that the 12 tribes get regathered. And then Messiah gets glorified, sets his feet down on the Mount of Olives, and Israel's the head of all nations. And they no longer will be in exile again. Now, we're told in Jeremiah chapter 30 and verse 7. Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7. Alas, for that day is great, and there's none like it. What day is great? That day is great. What day? The day of the Lord. It's great. It's none like it. That day is the time of Jacob's trouble. The day of the Lord is the time of Jacob's trouble, but he will be saved or redeemed out of it or from it. That day, there is none like it. So if there's none like it, how is the God of Israel going to prepare us for it? There's none like it, but how is he going to tell us about it? What's he got to compare it to if there's none like it? Well, he already has given us type and shadow to understand it because he's already declared what it will be like, even though there's none like it. From the beginning, he declared the end from the beginning. So what the Babylonians and the Syrians and the Greeks and the Romans did is sort of like what's going to be happening in the time of Jacob's trouble. It's likened to all that, but it's on a greater scale. Well, how am I going to understand the 12 tribes in exile being regathered to the land if from the time that they were exiled, they corporately, as all 12 tribes, has never come back? How am I going to understand it if they've never been united and the exile is not ended? Well, it's like it happened in Egypt. So there's got to be a pharaoh and a beast system that will not let his people go. And the God of Israel is going to be challenging Pharaoh or the beast system to let his people go. Pharaoh will say, I don't acknowledge the Lord. Who's he? He's not in my book of gods. I got a lot of God books, but not that God. And so the God of Israel say, I mean, you don't know of me? All those other gods in your God books, they're imagination of your mind. I'm the only one true God, and you don't know me? Well, I'll introduce myself. And so there's plagues, and it's in the midst of the plagues that he takes his people out of Egypt. Do you realize when you're studying the Torah each week, you know, he's brought us back and given us a heart for the Torah. We're identifying with the Torah. We read a Torah portion every week on the Sabbath. Do you know what the heart and the center of what you're studying? You're studying about there was a person named Abraham who Yahweh Yeshua made covenant with, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He has to explain this family. They go into Egypt and how they got there and how they were mistreated and the miracle way and the details about how they were brought out. That's what you study. Now, why are you so eager to study that? I mean, why is it so important for you to study that every week? To study the details of that story? It's because of this principle. Hosea, in chapter 2, in verse 15. Hosea chapter 2, verse 15. I will give her her vineyards from there in the valley of Achor for a door of hope. The word Achor means trouble or troubling. The valley of trouble, the valley of trouble. Achor means trouble. The valley of trouble, the valley of trouble. What does that give you an allusion to? Jacob's trouble. The valley of trouble for a door of hope. How can a valley of trouble be a door of hope? Valley of trouble for a door of hope. This is the hope. She shall sing there as in the days of her youth, as in the day when she came up out of the land of Egypt. She will sing. See, she shall sing. And she'll sing as in the days of her youth. as of the day when she came out of Egypt. See, it will be like it was. Now we have Micah chapter 7, verse 15. Micah 7, verse 15 says, "According to the days of your coming out of the land of Egypt, according to those days, will I show unto him marvelous things." According to those days, will I, that's future, show unto him marvelous things. Do you realize? I already know what's going to happen. Because it's according to how it did happen. He's already told me how it is going to happen. Because it's according to how it did happen. So guess what? He's given us an open book test. We know what the problem is. And he's also told us how he's going to solve the problem. Who our enemy's going to be. How they're going to oppose us. And how the enemy's going to be dealt with. So, this is what we need to understand regarding the end of days. Now what I want to begin to do, since I've laid out for you that the redemption takes place in a period of time known as the Day of the Lord. And what's critical for you to understand is the Day of the Lord begins, the Messianic times begins with the tribulation. And it's during the tribulation that the 12 tribes are going to be regathered. Now, in Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 7, what is the tribulation called? Jacob's trouble. Do you remember what the name of the family of Yeshua, Yahweh, is? It's the house of Jacob. See, in Exodus chapter 19, verse 3, he spoke at Mount Sinai to the house of Jacob. And then in Luke chapter 1, verse 33, Luke chapter 1, verse 33, it says, "He will rule over the house of Jacob forever." So if the name of the family of the Messiah is the house of Jacob, and the tribulation is Jacob's trouble, then how do you escape it? If the name of the family of the Messiah is the house of Jacob, and the tribulation is called Jacob's trouble, then like, how do you escape it? You don't. It is a period of time that is set aside for Messiah to reveal himself to his people and to the world. Now, what is associated with this event of Messiah gathering the 12 tribes of Israel? Like, what's that likened to? Why is he doing this for? What does it mean when he does it? The answer is, it's likened unto a wedding and the joy of a wedding. So who he's redeeming is his bride. And when he redeems her, there's going to be a great celebration. I mean, we are going to have one kind of a wedding party. So now I want to communicate to you this principle. That the ingathering of the 12 tribes of Israel is likened unto the joy of a wedding. It's likened unto Messiah the bridegroom redeeming his bride. That's the principle. So let's look at that principle. Jeremiah in chapter 33 in verse 11. Jeremiah 33 verse 11 says, "The voice of joy, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride." That's wedding talk. the voice of joy, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, and the voice of the bride. That's wedding talk. What's linked with that thought? The last part of the verse says, I will cause to return the captivity of the land. Put the thought together. The voice of joy, the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom, the voice of the bride, I'm going to cause to return the captivity of the land. The returning of the captivity of the land is likened unto a wedding. Let's look at another example. Jeremiah chapter 31 and verse 10. Jeremiah 31 verse 10 says, Hear the word of the Lord, O ye nations, and declare it in the isles afar off, and say, He that scattered Israel will gather him and keep him as a shepherd does his flock. The subject is, He that scattered Israel will gather him. It's the gathering of the 12 tribes from the nations. That's the subject. What's linked with the thought? Jeremiah 31 verse 13. Then shall the virgin rejoice in the dance. He who scattered Israel will gather him. Then will the virgin rejoice in the dance. It's likened to the joy of a marriage. Let's look at it this way. Luke in chapter 15. Luke chapter 15 is, and beginning in verse 11, is what we call the parable of the prodigal son. And it says, A certain man had two sons. Now, if you were here for the sessions yesterday, you should have a foundation to know the meaning of that verse. Who are the two sons? Ephraim and Judah, northern kingdom, southern kingdom. And the younger of them said to his father, who's the younger of them? It would be Ephraim or the northern kingdom. Give me the portion of good that befalls me. Why is the younger of his sons able to say, give me the portion of goods that falls to me? Why is he able to say, give me those goods? Because Ephraim and Manasseh, in Genesis chapter 48, was given the birthright blessing of Jacob. This is the birthright blessing. Give me the portion of good that falls to me. And then it says, not many days after, the younger son gathered all he had and he took his journey into a far country. Remember yesterday from Daniel chapter 9 verse 7? Who was referred to as being far off? The northern kingdom. Remember Daniel chapter 9 verse 7? The children of Jerusalem and Judah are near, and all Israel is far off in the places where they've been scattered. So they went into a far country. That's speaking about Ephraim, the northern kingdom. And when he spent all, there arose a famine in the land, and he began to feed on swine, telling you Ephraim went and ate pig, which according to the Torah is like the most abominable thing that you can eat. So the characteristic of Ephraim is he's got the birthright blessing. He goes into a far country and he feeds on swine. And then it says there was a famine in the land. The famine is, it's like, I'm not getting spiritually fed. I'm not completely satisfied. There must be something more. So there was a famine and he began to be in want. And he came to his senses and said, verse 18, I'm going to arise and go to my father and say, Father, I've sinned against heaven. What's he saying? I've departed from Torah. And I'm going to return to Torah. But his father knew he was going to come. He was excited to see him. And his father, in Luke 15, verse 22, said to his servants, Bring the best robe, put a ring on his hand, shoes on his feet, and kill the fatted calf, and let's be merry. He's describing the joy of a marriage. He's telling us that the return of the younger son, Ephraim, is going to be associated with the father rejoicing and having a marriage. Who's the younger son? It's Ephraim. And who believes in the God of Israel and thought it was okay to eat pig? Well, we call those people Christians. But within Christianity, there's a movement to, Father, I've sinned against you, to return to Torah. So we repent. We quit eating pig. We celebrate the Sabbath. We keep the annual festivals. We seek to follow the Torah. But when in time is this happening? Well, like right before the father is ready to have a marriage, the uniting of the 12 tribes of Israel. And we see events happening in the world that we believe were coming to those days. Now let me give you another example that the coming of the Messiah is likened unto a marriage. Matthew chapter 25. The kingdom of heaven is likened unto 10 virgins which took their lamps and went forth to meet their bridegroom. Notice that in order to meet your bridegroom, you have to carry a lamp. What is that lamp? Well, first of all, what does a lamp do? It helps you see. If we go to Proverbs in chapter 6, in verse 23, it says, the commandment is a lamp, and the Torah is light. The commandment is a lamp, and the Torah is light. So, the 10 virgins. Who's called a virgin? Israel in the nations regathered is called a virgin. He who scattered Israel will gather him, then will the virgin rejoice in the dance. But 5 were wise and 5 were foolish. Yesterday, I gave you some scriptures about the definition of who is wise in understanding, one who follows Torah. Who's foolish? Obviously the opposite of someone that's wise. They don't follow Torah. So why the 5? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. 5 wise are those who are following Torah. 5 foolish are those who are not following Torah. It says in verse 6, at midnight there is a cry made, behold, the bridegroom comes. So when was it announced? When was the proclamation made that the bridegroom's coming? At midnight. What does the word midnight mean? Midnight. The word means the middle of the night. So, if it's the middle of the night, what's the beginning of the night that it's talking about? The day of the Lord. The day of the Lord begins in darkness. But he's coming in the middle of the darkness. If the darkness is the tribulation, what's the middle of the darkness? We call it the last 3.5 years. We call it the Great Tribulation. And what I'm going to be showing you in the next session is that's exactly when the 12 tribes are going to be regathered, at midnight, the last 3.5 years. And there was a cry made, he comes, go to meet him. Notice it was then that they all arose and trimmed their light, trimmed their lamps. When did they all realize that he was coming? At midnight. They didn't realize it till midnight. Midnight is at the start of the Great Tribulation. Christianity won't realize that something's going on that they need to get serious about at the beginning of the night. It will only be at midnight that they realize it. So we're going to go over in the next session, what are the events that happen at the midnight hour of the tribulation that causes everyone to take notice? But then what happened is the foolish tried to buy. What does that mean? Get knowledge and understanding about what's going on. But as they went to buy, there wasn't anyone selling. And they got left out. You see, the coming of the Messiah is likened to a marriage. sadly, some, the foolish, get left out because they're not able to buy. What they're seeking to buy is the understanding of Messiah's coming, which they previously thought they had, but they don't. Because they previously thought they was going to be raptured, pre-tribulation rapture. But all of a sudden, it's the middle of the night. And they don't have what they need to understand His coming. And there's not much time to explain it. Guess what? You're still blessed. Because you still have had an opportunity to have a two-day seminar on this subject to understand it. The day is coming when this is not possible. You're still blessed. The foolish are going to come to a point where, you know, it's time to get out of here. It's not time to hold seminars. It's midnight. We got to get out. It's not time to hold seminars. So, the coming of the Messiah and Him gathering the 12 tribes of Israel is likened unto a marriage. And He gathers her during the tribulation period. Let's look at Isaiah in chapter 60. Isaiah chapter 60. Verse 1 says, "Arise, shine, for your light is come, and the glory of the Lord is risen upon you." Who is the glory of the Lord risen upon? The 12 tribes of Israel who are gathered. And He's gathering His bride. So who's His glory upon? His bride. You know, He shows His bride to the whole world. Look how beautiful she is. When is your light shining upon His bride? Verse 2, "Behold, darkness shall cover the land and gross darkness the people." At the time that there's gross darkness, not darkness, gross darkness upon the people, "the Lord will arise and His glory will be seen upon you." Now Isaiah in chapter 62. Isaiah chapter 62 in verse 1. "For Zion's sake will I not hold my peace, and her salvation as a lamp that burns." You get that? Zion's salvation is as a lamp that burns. Whose lamp was burning in Matthew 25? The wise virgins. As a lamp that burns. And it says in verse 4, "You will no longer be termed forsaken." Verse 5, "For as a young man marries a virgin, so shall your sons marry you. And as the bridegroom rejoices over the bride, so shall God rejoice over you. I have set watchmen on your walls, O Jerusalem." There are watchmen on the walls of Jerusalem that's waiting for the coming of the Messiah, and they're ready to blow the shofar to announce it. I've set watchmen. Jeremiah chapter 31, verse 6. We'll end the session with this verse. Our 90 minutes is up, right? It says, Jeremiah 31, verse 6, "For there shall be a day that the watchman upon a Mount Ephraim will cry, arise and let us go to Zion." See, He set watchmen on your walls, O Jerusalem. And what's the watchman doing? He's saying, arise and let us go to Zion. What is going to Zion? Zion is Messiah gathering the 12 tribes of Israel. So in the next session, we'll go into further detail explaining what are the events that are happening in the world that are linked with the gathering of the 12 tribes of Israel. Pray it's been a blessing to you. Shalom in Yeshua the Messiah. Amen.